It's time for Talkward with Matthew Fondevant.
I remember well the strange hotels, hospitals.
I have so been enjoying my talks, and I have a few interesting ones lined up. But I thought in the meanwhile, I would speak to a civil, a renowned, well, hang on. Can you be both renowned and civil, firstly? And what is civil engineering, and why is a lady doing it?
Oh, a lady. So I absolutely believe that you can be both renowned and civil, but I probably think you can count those on your one hand. So I'm only one of the two. I'm civil, and only to an extent, because I was never a good engineer, and I was definitely never a natural engineer. But I am a woman, and that's something that just happened to be what it was, and it is essentially meaningless.
Okay, but hang on. So no, you're currently presenting yourself as some sort of expert. So in that regard, I am obliged to draw out of you your qualifications. So you say you're an engineer and one of the civil variety, but not renowned. Where did you study?
So I studied for my BSc in civil engineering at the University of Natal, as it was known then, Durban.
The University of Natal?
It was called, in the old days, the University of Natal, and that's where I studied and got my degree.
Okay, so you learned colonialist engineering. Okay, yeah. And after that?
So I think we need to decolonize engineering. But that's a topic for another day. And after
decolonize
that...
Decolonize it. No columns.
No. Oh. I just want the colonies out of it completely. Oh. Once and for all.
Thank God we can keep the columns. Jeez, like...
No, engineering is all about columns and spreadsheets and Excel. I mean, an engineer would be nothing without Excel.
Oh, no, I thought columns, but things that hold bridges up.
Oh, those are also relevant, yes. Thank you for reminding me of the importance of actual
columns. But anyway, so you learnt colonialism and engineering at the University of Natal, as it then was.
Yes.
And then?
So then I worked for, I think, roughly 10 years, and for various reasons became interested in following different direction.
And back in those days, as a woman, I mean, how many women engineering students were there in your well, when was this, and how many women engineering students were there in your class?
I graduated in 1998, and there were two of us. And
was the other one gay?
No.
I'd like to apologize at this point for what I just said. It was inappropriate, and I think the guest dealt with the obvious male privilege and chauvinism that characterized the approach of the interviewer. And again, all we can do is apologize.
No. And she was lovely, but... I never heard of her again after university. So every now and again, I would go on LinkedIn to see.
She got married.
She did
sensibly.
Get married. She got married in our final year. I went to her wedding, which was lovely.
Nice.
And then she disappeared. So I don't know. I hope she was successful, because she was much more clever than I was.
Oh.
And sort of presentable.
But you say disappeared. This is not a true crime. I mean, she is still alive as far
she
as you know.
She disappeared from my...
Radar.
Okay.
So when you say civil engineer, what interests me is I had two civil engineers, both of whom were...
You had two?
Well, I have... Well, one is dead and the other one is still alive, but he's retired. My uncle was a civil engineer, and he was generally civil, but I do remember as a child...
Was he renowned?
No. I think there's a building called Hutton something or other, which is related to my family... in Johannesburg, because my grandfather was a certainly in my, so he was the grandfather who I would put my broken glasses in front of that had a scribbled broken next to it, because I'd broken my glasses and I couldn't see anything. And then I'd wake up in my grandma's feather bed the next morning, and there would be my glasses with the broken, scratched out and fixed, and my grandfather would present those to me. And so he was a civil engineer. And he also taught me how to change the backlights of a vehicle, parking, reverse, and brake lights. And he was actually a wonderful man. But both of them were men, and I like women engineers. I mean, how is it for you guys? Because I'm sure you're subjected to all sorts of expectations, because now you're a woman doing engineering and you have to, what do you have to be? You have to be sort of woke and yeah. Well,
do you have a few hours?
Well, I feel like I've been talking for about an hour already, so I'm going to hand the stage to you to extrapolate.
Okay, so you have asked several questions in the half an hour that you were leading into this question. When I first started working as an engineer, I think it needs to be sort of just distinguished between consulting engineering and engineers that work in a contracting business. And the most civil of people, the most civil of graduates, including probably the women, would naturally gravitate towards the consulting engineering field, which is generally an office-based job, very scientific, very design-oriented. And, you know, I was never that kind of person.
So you have never participated in water cooler banter in the office? The office was not for you?
The office was not for me, but mainly because I had a bursary with a construction company. And frankly, if I'd had a bursary with a consulting engineering company, I would have gone there. So it was not a choice that I made consciously, but
you ended up with boots on,
in hindsight,
building dams and stuff.
Yes, in hindsight, it was absolutely the right thing for me to do. I was never going to be a designer. My brain doesn't really function like that. I mean, I'd scraped through my engineering degree. We must just be clear. So it would have been irresponsible.
What do you mean
scraped
through?
Yeah, I got... Well, let me tell you
a
story.
No, but hang on. No, scraped through to the extent that there's a possibility that someone, somewhere, somehow could unearth some document which could really, take the carpet from under you, or scraped through in the sense that you have the degree validly earned.
Okay, so let me tell you. I've got the valid degree.
Okay, well, that's all that matters.
No, let me tell you a little story.
Okay.
So at school, in school, I was an achiever, you know, the type. Quite easy for me to get high marks without...
You were easy.
I was very easy, and I easily achieved the marks necessary for whatever I needed to do. And that changed very dramatically when I started studying engineering, especially physics, chemistry, all of those things that I thought I understood.
Because it's really, really hard.
Really hard.
Even Newtonian physics is impossible.
I don't even know what Newtonian physics is, frankly, at this stage. But let me get back to my story.
Oh,
so
sorry.
There's this thing called, I think it was called the Washington Accord, which was an agreement between 8 countries, including South Africa, the USA, Canada, Australia, UK, and a few others, that any person earning a degree at that university in that year would forevermore be recognized internationally as impeccable. So, in my
final
year...
Oh, so you're now civil and impeccable.
I'm impeccable. So in my final year, it was, I think they did a review every 4 years. In my final year, they did a review, and they, I don't know what they do. They go through the syllabus and the exams and so on. But they then also interviewed 3 students, and it was always very clear that they were going to choose 3 students, one being an exceptionally good student, one being a really borderline student, and one being a middle-of-the-road student. So I was named as one of the 3 students, and just looking at the other 2, it was clear to me that I could only have been the borderline student. And that to me was quite a shock after always having sort of easily.
Wait, hang on. Is the borderline
things.
The middle of the road one?
No, no.
The borderline is the lowest one.
Is the one that
you wouldn't actually ask her to design your bridge.
Well, I think that's the point that I was making. You wouldn't want me to design your bridge, but I've got other attributes.
So how many bridges have you designed?
None. Oh. And I never
will. Okay, so what do you do then? I remember my grandfather, he worked by hand, and he had an enormous, like an architect's thing with a ruler, which went both
I know. They're wonderful. They're wonderful. And they have like a little lever.
Yes, and then various protractors and compasses. So you can't do any of that stuff.
Well, I could do the minimum required to pass. But okay. I mean,
but what, so what
I,
do you actually
knew
do now?
That beyond
you know,
that, I was
let's
useless.
Move past what you're not good at, and okay. what are you good at?
I'm good at a few things.
Yes.
Matthew.
Okay. Go ahead.
But not to a level that I would call myself renowned. I am good at practical problem solving, I think, and that really is what construction is about. It's about achieving efficiency and productivity and dealing, hopefully ahead of time, with problems that might arise, and when they have arisen and you have not been able to deal with them, is sort of to try and put out whatever fires have been caused by the problem.
How important is it for the current modern day South African construction company to uphold the rule of law?
I think the answer to that question might very well vary from person to person. In my mind, it is absolutely crucial. Non-negotiable. Anything beyond that is unacceptable, because we have good legislation dealing with things like public procurement in particular, and I think that is probably the one area where I'm not sure how it can happen, but I think it's probably the one area that is still vulnerable to some form of corruption or political influence and so on.
And so on, and so on, and so on, and so on.
And so on. Go on.
Well, I think I was just going to point out that human nature in every industry is probably the same, that some people are prone to being influenceable and some are not.
So are you suggesting that the engineering profession and building and construction, the integrity requirements, are those applicable to a lawyer? Because if you're saying that, I completely disagree. I mean, you're just business people, aren't you? It's the bottom line. You have to make a profit without having your employees rebel.
Well, I think the key thing to understand about engineering and construction people is really that they only really care about the thing that they are designing and building. They don't want to have this noise around them about money and the business environment, and especially not the political environment. So to make up for that lack of interest, companies generally do end up being run by people that would be more easily described as business people. And there's always going to be a gap between a business-minded person and the person who just really wants to build something, stand back, look at it in 20 years' time, show his children or grandchildren, this is what I built. It's a very, very different mindset.
What was it like being a young female engineer when you were one, as in recently qualified, on site with a whole lot of what I'd imagine? I mean, I remember the engineering students, they featured in my songs. There was a song about the Witzblitz campus of gloom, BCom, briefcase, Ray-Ban, blues.
Great.
Yes, and it's talked about the engineers with their flip-flops
and shorts. Yes.
Shorts and just the sort of vulgarity of them. How did you deal with that on site? On site!
That is a very complicated question to answer, and the thing is that I can only answer it subjectively. And one of the things that really annoy me nowadays, really annoys me, is the fact that I'm often asked to speak for women in engineering, women in construction. I mean, you just have to go on LinkedIn to see women in realty, women in this, women in that.
I know, they're like everywhere these days.
I know, especially, it's just women, especially women, in August. I mean, August can never end quickly enough for me because of this thing. And
yeah, but it's because it's Women's Month.
I know. But to get back to the question, so obviously I can only describe my own experience. Right. I was one of the, well, at the time when I started working for the construction company I did start working for, and as I said, purely because I had a bursary with them, I was the only woman that they had employed on a site. I decided before I even started working there that I would put up with anything thrown my way. Because I knew that it would pass, and it did pass, and so all of that's behind me now, and all the difficulties and hardships and pain and whatever it was that I went through, that's all well behind me now, and I'm a better person for it.
Denial, the river.
The river in Egypt.
Not that one, no. The other thing I wanted to ask you as a civil engineer, there's talk about sort of gangsterism involved in national development projects, so road building and bridge building and, you know, things, infrastructural development, which is being held to ransom in some instances, so I've heard, by what appear to be pretty well organized gangster groups. Give us the lowdown. Give us your take on what's going on there.
Okay, so it needs to be very clear that there are two separate issues here. The one is the development of the local people that happen to live wherever a new construction project happens.
And who can have any difficulty with that?
No one can have any difficulty with that, and I don't believe I know anyone that has any difficulty with the idea of leaving something good behind, you know, creating some jobs.
A few jobs.
Improving some skills, etc. So that is a pure good concept, and I don't think anyone has a problem with that.
I don't.
But that, unfortunately, is being used as a disguise for what you've just described.
Oh, disguise. So cloak and dagger.
Cloak and dagger. Sometimes not even. Sometimes it's very much open, out in the open. But, I mean, there is, and it's well reported in the media, that the idea of the construction mafia, they called. And it started really around public sector contracts and the requirements that I think were legislated somewhere.
Well, to do with roads mainly.
Not necessarily roads, but I think it's where it started. But it's got to do with the requirement in all government sector contracts to, for the main contractor to subcontract 30% of its contract value to local subcontractors and labor and so on. And then it's subdivided between women-owned companies.
Yeah, but hang on. You have a 2 billion rand contract.
Yes.
To build a bridge. And you have to allocate 30% of that to the local community. So I would imagine, in the context of building some massive project like a big dam or a bridge or even an extension to a national road, something like that, that costs, you know, runs into the billions, to give or to be forced to allocate 30% of that amount to local contractors who clearly don't have the necessary expertise is just fishing for outside forces to become involved and do what they do, which is to ultimately defraud the general public who are fully supportive of the idea of leaving a good footprint on the back of infrastructure development.
You hardly need a podcast guest, actually, because you're summing it up so well. So it definitely varies. And the project type and nature makes a huge difference. And that's unfortunately what's not recognized in the general sort of blanket approach of 30%. So the right kind of contract has a lot of scope for low-skilled workers and for a small subcontracting company to acquire skills. Because, I mean, we mustn't forget that that noble intention is, in fact, for these subcontractors to become self-sustaining and learn the skills that they need.
I have to tell you, the person that I associate most strongly with any infrastructure, particularly road development, is that first person who greets you as they announce. And it's often a fairly buxom woman in overalls with shiny things on her, properly issued overalls.
Yes, I know what you mean. And it is, I think your choice of the word ambassador is quite correct. But there are reasons for what you see on a construction site, and there are probably reasons why the first person you see, I mean, obviously just generalizing here, is a woman. And that is because government policy dictates certain things in terms of who you should employ and who should have priority. And
why
so on.
Should women not have priority given
no,
our
no, no, they absolutely
history.
Should have priority. But there's a reason why they end up usually waving a flag, and I have issue with that.
Well, when you say waving a flag, to me what they're doing is introducing me to a serious detour, and they perform a really important task.
No, I totally understand that. I just have difficulty with the idea that the reason for all these policies and legislation being in place is that the idea should be that once a construction project has established itself in an area and then done its year or two or three or whatever, when that construction company leaves, the idea is that true skills and development has happened. And I have difficulty with the idea of somebody being put into a job like that that ultimately develops no skills.
Okay, so how do you get someone from a seriously previously disadvantaged background to get the necessary opportunities to be more than what, for me, I reiterate, is the most important part of any construction project?
So that is the million-dollar question, and I totally support the...
Just $1 million?
Well, several if you wish. But I totally support the objectives of this. I just have real difficulty with whether the way it's being implemented really pays off. For instance, I have difficulty with the idea that you are forced as a contractor to employ a certain number of people in a certain number of companies locally. Because what that results in is, as you travel through the company on various sites, you create jobs for 10 people for 1 year. And I'm just wondering how that is different to creating a job for one person for 10 years in terms of the benefit ratio. In terms of a construction company, the one person for 10 years is much more productive because that person can get really good at what he does. He has incentives to improve. Whereas if you know you're only going to have a job for 1 year, you have no real incentive to get really good at what you do because you know that you're going to lose that job after that year. And that's just my opinion, but I find that concept very difficult to grasp.
Okay, so this discussion has become about the struggles of the woman who waves us into a construction area somehow.
But, has it?
Well, in my mind, what's it been about for you?
Well, I mean, it's the same concept that I was just trying to explain that I struggle with. It might well be that what I see as a really hard and sort of thankless job, being vulnerable to all sorts of attacks, especially from motorists and aggression and so on. And let me tell you, the fact that a lot of these roads jobs are often in rural areas, that poor woman standing alone is very vulnerable to all sorts of attacks and
rape.
So on. All sorts of attacks and general abuse by motorists and so on. They don't want to wait at stop and go. So it's not an easy job.
Well, this totally explains why their response to me has been universally friendly and welcoming, because I give them a good old toot hello. I think we've avoided talking about things that are close to your heart in this interview for obvious reasons that we needn't get into. But I would like you to talk about something that I just happen to know is sort of very important to you on an emotional level and was necessary and important in getting you through the terrible last 20, 21 months or so. And I'm talking, obviously, about your two chickens, Henrietta and Ivy. So just talk about them for a little bit, please.
Well, I love Henrietta and Ivy. But how we got to have Henrietta and Ivy was really stemming from my need to, at all times, have some sort of a grand project to sort of engage with and to just to have a sense of interest in. So the project with the two chickens really started with a failed attempt at a vegetable garden because it was barren and dry and it needed fertilization. So obviously my next thought was, ooh, we need compost. My next thought was, what do we need to feed this compost heap with? And obviously the answer was chicken manure. Then I thought, oh, free organic eggs. Obviously, get chickens. So I did, and I spent a very satisfying few months constructing a little area for them, a pen with a nice little picket fence and a little hutch or coop with a little ladder. And ultimately the day came that we went and chose these two chickens from a farm of a kind friend. And we came home with Henrietta, who's sort of a redhead, and Ivy, who's white and lovely and likes a good scratch.
White and lovely and likes a good scratch.
On the little head.
What I like most about chickens, females.
Oh, it's the thighs and the drumstick.
No, it's the fact that you can sneak up behind them and their instinct, which has been bred into them by us, tells them to expect a cock.
Again, all I can do is apologize.
And they sort of go into this weird submissive trance during which you can do anything to them. And just to be clear,
I was just going to ask, what would you like to do?
No.
Sort of scratch their little heads and stroke their feathers.
Exactly.
Yes, they like that.
Yeah, but the fact of the matter is why they are doing it is so my experience of the hen is they live a terrible life, and all the metaphors that go along with them, brooding hens and, you know, hen-pecked, I completely understand them now, having experienced chickens and the females, because you're not allowed males in the suburbs because they make too much of a noise. So you just have these, I mean, they often just confine themselves to their quarters for days in this weird trance-like state because they have realized that all they're doing is laying duds every day.
But I mean, and you have to give this to them. They always, always try their best to achieve their full potential, which in their minds, I guess, consists of getting sort of an egg that actually hatches into a little chick. And that's what they don't understand. It's never going to happen for them. They're always just going to supply us with a wonderful supply of fresh eggs. That's what they're here for. And the manure, of course, for the compost heap.
How's the compost heap going?
Oh, it's going very well.
Oh, good.
It's looking very, very good.
Oh, so your garden is flourishing.
It's all that I was hoping for.
I've had lots of time to think, and I don't know what to think. I am impatient for something, I don't know what it is. I wish I knew. I'm dodging shots.
Okay, that was episode 6 with civil engineer Stephanie Simpson. Episode 7 is coming soon, and I'm hopeful. This was Talk Ward with Matthew van der Vondt. Good night.
I lost something on the road. Lighthouse.